thank you all for coming today, and thanks to the Federalist Society and the American Bankers Association for sponsoring this event. My name is Hester Peirce, and I'm a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Dean Reuter of the Federalist Society had told us that we could not expect a lot of people to come today because the Volcker Rule just is not as big a draw as maybe Supreme Court type issues or constitutional issues. So I guess my goal is that by the end of today's lively discussion, you will all think that the Volcker Rule is much more fascinating than the Constitution. Before I turn it over to the experts, I just want to give you some quick background about how we got where we are today. I think most of you probably already know that, but let me just go quickly through it. The so-called Volcker Rule is actually Section 619 of the Dodd-Frank Act. And as you might guess from the name, it started out as a glimmer in the eye of former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, who was concerned about banks engaging in risky trading activity with the backdrop of the deposit insurance guarantee. Translating this simple concept into legislative language was no easy task, but it's one that Senators Levin and Merkley took on with great enthusiasm. And as a result, we have a statutory prohibition that prohibits banks and their affiliates from engaging in proprietary trading and limits their relationships with hedge funds and private equity funds. With the passage of Dodd-Frank, Congress handed off the baton to probably some very reluctant regulators to turn this statutory prohibition into regulatory language. And the Financial Stability Oversight Council started out by doing a study, which came out in January of last year. And then in October 2011, after the rule was supposed to be finalized, the regulators came out with a proposal. The regulators who did that proposal were the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, the FDIC, and the SEC. And then in sort of an odd assertion of regulatory independence, the CFTC decided to wait a few months, and they put out their proposal in January. The comment period for the banking regulators and the SEC proposal finished on Monday, and there were many comments, and the CFTC's comment period runs until April. But regardless of when the agencies actually adopt a rule, the statute has an effective date of July 21, 2012, which is coming up quickly. The length, complexity, and number of questions that were contained in the Volcker Rule proposal surprised many observers. And as you know, some of the content also has drawn a fair bit of criticism. Market participants that will be affected by the rule contend that the regulators were far too aggressive and failed to fully appreciate the far-reaching unintended consequences of their proposal. Senator Merkley gave voice to the sentiment on the other side of the issue when he stated earlier this week that the proposal was a step in the right direction, but far too timid, and he called for immediate action. Our panelists have graciously agreed to take a break from reading the many comment letters to guide us through the tremendous technical complexities of the rule. And so we'll start with Mark Vanderweide, who will provide us with a quick overview of the rule and some of the challenges that went into breathing regulatory life into the statutory text. Mark is Senior Associate Director and Chief of Staff for Policy in the Federal Reserve Board's Division of Banking Supervision and Regulation. Mark has been at the Fed since 1998, except for a stint during 2009 to 2010 when Treasury borrowed him to work on financial reform. Prior to joining the Fed, Mark was an associate at Cleary Gottlieb. He's a graduate of University of Iowa and Yale Law School. And I can testify that during meetings with Senate Banking Committee during the crisis, he exhibited good cheer and calm, and I'm sure that'll come in handy during the attacks on the rule that he's been working on. Corianne Stephenson will explain some of the challenges associated with the proprietary trading aspects of the rule. She's director of the Financial Services Regulatory Practice at PwC, where she advises clients on a wide range of issues, including the impact of Dodd-Frank and Basel implementation. It sounds like she's spending a lot of time on Volcker these days. Prior to joining PricewaterhouseCoopers, she was the associate director of the Large Institution Group at the Fed. Among other things, during the financial crisis, Corey ran the stress tests. Before that, she led Basel II implementation for the Federal Reserve System. She also held a number of key positions at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In addition, she spent a number of years trading bank debt and brokering derivatives. She's a graduate of Purdue University. Randall Gwynn will discuss the portion of the rule that deals with covered funds. Randy is a partner at Davis Polk & Wardwell, where he heads the Financial Institutions Group. He has advised a diverse list of clients, including U.S. and foreign banks, securities firms, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, on issues related to the financial crisis and Dodd-Frank implementation. He also advises clients on a whole range of strategic, regulatory, and banking issues. Before joining Davis Polk, he clerked for Judge J. Clifford Wallace on the Ninth Circuit and for Chief Justice William Rehnquist. He's a graduate of Brigham Young University and University of Virginia Law School. Finally, Sally Miller will discuss concerns unique to banks that are headquartered outside the United States. Sally is the Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of International Bankers, where she helps to resolve legislative, regulatory, tax, and compliance issues that are confronting internationally headquartered financial institutions that engage in banking, securities, and insurance activities in the United States. Prior to joining the IIB in 2010, she was Senior Vice President at the American Bankers Association. She also served as Executive Director and General Counsel for the ABA Securities Association. Prior to joining the ABA, Sally served as Special Counsel at the Securities and Exchange Commission. She's a graduate of Boston University and American University's Washington College of the Law. So once the panelists have given their initial thoughts, I will allow them to ask each other a few tough questions and may ask a few of my own, and then we'll turn over the microphones to you to ask your own questions. So Mark, I'll turn it over now to you.
Let me begin also by thanking the Federal Society and the American Bankers Association for inviting the Fed to come and speak at this event. I have the pleasure of introducing my remarks this afternoon with not one but two different disclaimers. The first is that although I'm an employee of the Federal Reserve Board, what I say today will be my views and my views only and may or may not reflect the views of the board staff as a consensus or the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. Secondarily, because the interagency proposal is just that at this point, it is an outstanding proposal, I will be relatively limited in my ability to try to forecast how we're going to respond to the 17,000 comments that have come in or what the final rule will look like. I suspect that many of you are pretty familiar with the contents of the Volcker Rule, but nevertheless, I think it might be helpful to just give a few paragraphs summary of what the statute does and how the agency's proposed rule attempts to implement the statutory framework. The statutory provisions that make up the Volcker Rule effectively prohibit banking entities from engaging in two different activities. First, proprietary trading, and the second is investing in or sponsoring or having certain relationships with private equity funds or hedge funds. The statutory provisions apply in general to insured depository institutions of all kinds, companies that own, control insured depository institutions, and foreign banks that have a U.S. branch, agency, or U.S. subsidiary bank, and any affiliates or subsidiaries of any of those kinds of entities. Pretty broad scope. Under the statute, proprietary trading is defined as taking a position as principal in any security or derivative for the purpose of selling that position in the near term, or otherwise with the intent to resell to profit from short-term price movements. The statute applies only to positions taken by a banking entity as principal for the purpose of making short-term profits. It does not apply to positions taken for long-term or investment purposes. Moreover, the statute contains a number of very important exceptions, including an underwriting, market making, and hedging exception. The implementing rule proposed by the agencies incorporates all of these definitions and exceptions. The statute also authorizes the relevant regulatory agencies to permit additional activities if they would promote and protect safety and soundness of banking firms and advance the financial stability of the United States. The second major prohibition in the statute forbids a banking entity from acquiring an ownership interest in or having certain relationships with a hedge fund or a private equity fund, what in our rule we call a covered fund. Again, the statute contains a number of exceptions, including for organizing and offering a covered fund to clients, making limited investments in such a covered fund, sponsoring and investing in loan securitizations, and hedging activities. The statutory definition of a fund covered under the Volcker Rule is quite broad. I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit today. The statute also quite broadly prohibits any banking entity that serves as an investment advisor or a sponsor to a covered fund from engaging in certain transactions with the fund, including lending to or purchasing assets from the fund. I think it's an understatement to say that the Volcker Rule is a complicated statute that prevents complicated implementation challenges. I suspect my fellow panelists will highlight a number of those potential challenges in detail, so I'll just highlight one key example. On the proprietary trading side, one of the most difficult tasks, probably the most difficult task for regulators and banking entities, is to differentiate prohibited proprietary trading activity from permitted market-making activity, when in fact these two distinct activities share several very important characteristics. In both activities, the banking entity generally acts as principal in trading the underlying position, holds that position, but usually only for a relatively short period of time, and enjoys profits or suffers losses from any price variation in the position while the banking entity holds that position. The statute distinguishes between these activities by looking to the purpose of the trade and the intent of the trader. These subjective characteristics can be hard to discern in practice, especially for a complex global firm that engages in thousands or tens of thousands of trading transactions per day. To address this formidable challenge, the proposed rule articulated a multifaceted implementation framework to the prop trading prohibition that included, among other elements, an internal compliance program, data collection and reporting requirements, and an explanation of the factors the agencies would use to differentiate prohibited from permitted trading activities. As the board's Governor Cirullo noted recently in testimony on the Volcker Rule, this approach is admittedly not a simple one. And indeed, much has been made of the length and complexity of the interagency proposed rule and the number of questions on which it seeks comment. I think, however, that those aspects of the proposal are best understood as a recognition by the rulemaking agencies that first, there are important and complex issues involved in the Volcker Rule, and the second, we're committed to getting the details right and really want lots of feedback from the industry and the public, which is what we've gotten.
They delivered.
The board and the other agencies have received, I think, 17,000 comments now on the proposal, which I believe is a Dodd-Frank record for the Fed, at least. Not a lifetime record on rulemakings, but it's in the top five. But it's a Dodd-Frank record, I think. And we look forward to the process of carefully considering all of those comments and formulating a final rule that implements the Volcker Rule in a manner that's faithful to the language of the statute and that maximizes financial stability and other social benefits from the statute at the least cost to credit availability and economic growth. Thanks.
Great, thanks. Hi, my name is Corey Stephenson, and as Hester said, I am a director at Pricewaterhouse, where I have been spending possibly the last, year of my life working with a range of foreign and domestic banking institutions as they struggle through understanding the rule, preparing for the rule, thinking about strategy shifts, implementing and developing compliance programs, et cetera. I'm sure many of you are very familiar with the different elements of the rule regarding the prohibition on proprietary trading, but I thought that I would point out a few areas where as to Mark's point, that I see the industry really struggling. And to his early example, the narrowness of how market making has been defined is extremely problematic. A rule that's based on intent is very hard to demonstrate, particularly when the rule is written in a way that you're almost presumed guilty, so you have to defend yourself from, why this trade is, or why this action is reasonable given the exemption. I think that points out another area of the rule that's problematic is that while it talks about portfolio and thinking through a portfolio type, which is that's exactly the way a trader manages his book, there are times that different elements of the rule seem to be very transaction-based. And, traders, especially at a multinational bank, are talking about hundreds and thousands of transactions and not, some of these one-off. You hedge as a portfolio. You manage risk as a portfolio. So when things become very transactions-based, it's very different from sort of the business as usual. Certainly one of the areas, the other part, I think, in the narrowness is the whole concept of your revenue should be derived more from commissions and fees and the spread capture than, and very little should be reflected from the benefit of positive market moves on your existing portfolio. I think that is one that's very difficult, A, to manage, and B, I find that the economics of the actual trading business changes very much. If all of a sudden you take that off the table, You know, you are a liquidity provider, and as a liquidity provider, you're usually going to be providing that exactly when it's a bad time to be holding that debt. So therefore, if you think of trading as sort of a zero-sum game, you're basically saying all the profits go back to customer street, et cetera, and the banks are going to be in the losing business. And I think from the stabilities of capital markets, you think that eventually, if that's the way the market operates, you become less and less involved in actually being a liquidity provider. Some of the other areas that, and I know that Sally will probably be talking about solely outside of the United States, that's definitely, at least for my time, it's been adding to my billable time because I get to listen to the rants and raves of it and nodding the entire time. But that is one that provokes an awful lot of discussion, let us say, from our friends on the foreign side. I think from the compliance and metrics perspective, the compliance requirements seem fairly reasonable. The metrics, I sympathize with the industry. I sympathize that, you know, it's more burden, et cetera. And I think that there was an attempt, and I'm speaking sort of from what I, from my experience working at the board, I think there was an attempt when I read through the language that, you know, that people tried to make it as less burdensome as they believed. And certainly, you know, on the risk management metrics, those are traditional sort of risk management metrics that you would expect a large trading shop to have. However, when you start to get into some of the detail on the P&L aspects, so spread P&L capture, trying to measure the concept of inventory or inventory turnover, and then putting that on an OTC derivatives book, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. So what you have is an industry that's struggling to try to comply. So we're all waiting for Mr. Van der Weer and his colleagues at the board to come out with the final rule on July 21st, 2012. And it's a lot of work. I hope you get finished the comments by that time. Thanks.
Okay, so just before I get into my remarks, we at Davis Polk love to come up with statistics about Dodd-Frank, and so of the nearly 17,000 letters that Mark referred to, we've now sort of categorized them. There are 295 individual letters, 16,457 form letters. There are 62 letters from U.S. industry groups, 35 from foreign industry groups. This is unusual, I think, 10 from foreign governments, 13 from U.S. agencies, 15 from members of Congress, 11 from banking entities that are U.S., 16 from foreign banking entities, and consumer groups, academic groups, and so forth. So a real cross-section. Now, I want to do the—I normally don't have disclaimers the way, you know, members of agencies do, but today I want to stress at the outset that the comments that I'm going to make are purely my personal views. I am not speaking on behalf of any financial institution or industry trade group. They would never let me be as intentionally provocative as I intend to be today. But my views are informed by 25 years of experience as a bank regulatory lawyer. So first, a prediction. Here's my prediction. If implemented and enforced as proposed, which I expect and sincerely hope that it won't be, the Volcker Rule and its implementing regulations will turn out to be an unmitigated disaster for the United States. It'll be a gift to our foreign competitors and enemies. It will produce untold harm and virtually no good. It will reduce the liquidity of our capital markets, especially our corporate debt markets. Borrowing for investment will become more expensive, resulting in lower output and higher unemployment. Contrary to conventional wisdom, it will not reduce the net riskiness of banking entities or banking groups. Indeed, it will make them more risky and more vulnerable to fail. It will replace billions of dollars of highly liquid mark-to-market assets with highly illiquid, highly risky long-term loans and other illiquid assets. What's truly sad is that all this harm will occur without a shred of verifiable evidence that proprietary trading or market making had anything to do with causing the financial crisis or the wave of bank failures in 2008. It will also occur without a plausible argument that proprietary trading or market making will cause any waves of bank failures in the future. The bank failures that occurred during the recent financial crisis were all caused the same way they always have been for the last 500 years, by the sudden, unexpected collapse of a bubble in asset values, in this case, real estate. That was followed by a general loss of public confidence in the value of the highly illiquid and opaque loans and asset-backed securities related to those assets whose price collapsed. That, in turn, was followed by a panic characterized by runs on the deposits, repos, and other short-term liabilities of the most vulnerable institutions, causing them to fail. That is the fundamental story behind the collapse of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, AIG, and all of the regional and community banks that failed during this financial crisis. The lesson from that record should be clear. We need more liquidity, not less liquidity. But rather than encourage this sort of market making that produces liquid markets, the proposed rules would presumptively prohibit it. Indeed, Mr. Volcker's latest justification for his ban on prop trading and the presumptive expansion of that ban in the proposed rules to genuine market making is that too much liquidity is bad. That argument is tantamount to saying that we'd all be better off if our markets were more illiquid and opaque. Does anybody seriously believe that to be the case? I don't think even Mr. Volcker does. Certainly, no one outside the United States does. That's why no other country is seriously considering adopting anything like the Volcker rule. Indeed, our competitors are licking their chops for the market making and fund activity that will inevitably migrate offshore. It's like deja vu all over again when an ill-advised tax on Yankee bonds resulted in the creation of the Eurobond market in the 1960s. Our enemies are also laughing as we self-inflict these wounds on our capital markets and competitiveness. Rather than construe the statutory exemption for market making fairly, the agencies have proposed to construe market making in the excessively narrow way that Senator Merkley has described it, as being effectively limited to securities brokerage and riskless principal activities. Every other type of market making is effectively presumed to be prohibited prop trading unless the presumption is overcome by some sort of evidence to the contrary. The Volcker rule has often been compared to the Glass-Steagall Act, but the Glass-Steagall Act was never this restrictive. It permitted the broker-dealer affiliates of insured banks to engage in proprietary trading and market making as long as they were principally engaged in bank-eligible activities such as, listen to this, prop trading in U.S. government securities, and there were firewalls between them and their affiliated banks. The Glass-Steagall Act only limited the market-making activities of insured banks to securities brokerage or riskless principal activities. Every other affiliate was able to engage in prop trading. Now, turning to the covered fund portion of the proposed rules that I was actually asked to speak on, the net effect is similar to expand the statutory prohibitions. The proposed rules apply to a category called covered funds. That term is defined in a way that sweeps in all sorts of corporate entities that have never been considered to be hedge funds or private equity funds, including wholly owned subsidiaries, insured banks, even bank holding companies themselves. So if enforced as written, which I don't think they will be, the proposed rules would actually prohibit a bank holding company from acting as a source of strength for its subsidiary banks, which is a bedrock principle in U.S. banking law. The rules would also appear to require bank holding companies to divest 100% of a large number of their non-fund affiliates, while ironically allowing them to retain 3% of their genuine hedge funds and private equity funds. This outcome turns the Volcker rule on its head. And so, having provoked everything, I look forward to the discussion.
I'm going to come at this from the foreign banking perspective, but before I do that, I want to also thank the Federalist Society and the ABA for including me here. I actually have my ABA retirement watch on right now. And I also want to say to Mark and his colleagues that we really do acknowledge the hard work of the agencies in trying to come up. It was a very difficult task, I'm sure, for them to implement the Volcker rule, but having said that, I think I can say fairly that we strongly disagree with their interpretation of the statute in a number of ways. So the first thing I'm going to focus on is sort of the extraterritorial aspects of the Volcker rule. Then I want to talk a little bit about the foreign government securities issue, and then I want to talk a little bit about the compliance regime. So we have in the statute what we call the SOTUS exceptions, the solely outside of the United States exceptions. And with respect to that, what Congress said is for foreign banking organizations that they deliberately and appropriately limited the extraterritorial effects of the Volcker rule by permitting foreign foreign banks to engage in prop trading if their home country laws allow it, and to sponsor and invest in covered funds if they are solely outside of the United States. What the agencies have done in the proposal, however, is they've added more layers on top of that. They've added further limitations. And basically what they've said is we're going to prohibit any U.S. nexus or ancillary activity. So you can't have a U.S. counterparty. You can't execute your transaction on a U.S. exchange or a CEF. And you can't transact through a U.S. agent. So what they've done is they've basically extended this to a broad range of what we would consider non-U.S. trading and fund activities. We think this extension is inconsistent with the statute, it's inconsistent with congressional intent, the Volcker Rule's policy objectives of protecting U.S. banks, the U.S. financial stability, and U.S. taxpayers, and it is against longstanding U.S. policy of limiting the extraterritorial scope of the U.S. banking laws. We think, I won't say it as eloquently as Randy did, but we definitely think the impact of these additional restrictions, limitations, will reduce liquidity in the U.S. markets and securities, and migration of trading to other financial centers and job losses in the U.S. Recently, we had a witness testify in front of the House Financial Services on this Volcker Rule, and in connection with preparing that particular witness for testifying, he cited a study that said that in 6 years, there's going to be more financial services jobs in Toronto than there are in London. And his posit is that they weren't coming from London, they were going to come from here. With respect to the non-U.S. government securities, I actually thought it was nine, so I'm wondering what government I have missed out on that. But we have from three continents, we have governments weighing in on the U.S. government exemption. What happened was is that the statute says that U.S. government securities, agencies, et cetera, will not be subject to the restrictions of the Volcker Rule. So you can engage in prop trading in these types of securities. But they didn't expand, the statute did not expand it to cover foreign government securities. Now, for the governments, obviously, they're very concerned. I remember talking to somebody at the Bank of Japan back in December, and he said, well, U.S. banks can still invest in Japanese debt, right? And I said, well, yeah, they can invest in it, but there's going to be somewhat of a chilling effect because they got to prove that they're, in fact, investing in it as opposed to prop trading. And his face actually went ashen. And for the Japanese to weigh in on these particular issues, it's my understanding is they usually don't do that as frequently as they've been doing on this one. Anyway, so we say that the agencies should exempt trading in all government securities from the Volcker Rule. I note yesterday's heard on the street column, the Wall Street Journal, that they said that there shouldn't be any exemption for any government securities. I think that ignores the fact that the statute actually did exempt U.S. government securities. So it's a statutory one, not anything that the agencies can do anything about. We believe that I know that all government debt is not equal, especially with what we're dealing with right now in the headlines, but we believe that there are other regulatory frameworks that can address this through capital regulation, supervisory authority, that they're more appropriate, they have more flexibility to address these concerns regarding bank exposure to sovereign debt. We think the Volcker Rule is a blunt sword, if you will. And it's really important for, and you will find in the comment letters, even foreign banks weighing in on this, that it's important to have U.S. firms have access to and be able to engage in proprietary trading with respect to foreign government securities, because they are, in many countries, also primary dealers of that government security, whether it's Japanese debt, whether it's U.K. gilts, et cetera. So we think the exemption is too narrow and needs to be broadened. They have the exemptive authority to cover government securities and address these issues. The last thing is that we think head offices and international bank affiliates should not have to implement the Volcker Rules compliance programs and reporting requirements. Obviously, Volcker applies to our branches and agencies doing business here in the U.S. They will have to comply with all of the restrictions and build a compliance program, but we don't think that the home offices or offices outside of the U.S. should have to build the compliance program. And Corianne didn't talk about it, but I think, what is it, 17 metrics that you have to measure on a daily basis and then report to the regulators on a monthly is basically at the top level in terms of compliance?
Right, you have to do 17 metrics if, in fact, you're trying to support
support a market making exemption. For other parts of the exemption, I think it's about 7 or 8. Either way, they're difficult, time consuming, and you're going to require fairly significant technological improvements in order to do that.
And so what we suggest is that the agencies go back and issue a new rule. They've certainly got how many did you say, individual 200? I know the heft of those comment letters are fairly significant, and that they go back and repropose and revise the conformance rules to provide adequate time after issuance of the final rule for banks to conform their activities.
Thank you all very much. I guess Sally's last point there leads me to my first question. Mark, you could make everyone here really happy if you told us that a reproposal is in the works.
We just got the comments. We need to take a look at them, and we'll make any decisions about next steps after we've had a chance to analyze the comments. This will be a theme of my remarks today going forward.
Okay, so do you have any insight you can give us on timing?
No, I mean, the statute does go into effect on July 21st, 2012. There is a several-year conformance period to give people some time to adapt their businesses to the final rule when it comes out. We'd like to get a final rule out before the effective date of the statute. We will work very hard to do that, but we have a lot of comments to process and a lot of thinking to do before we get there.
I would say, as a former Fed insider, the fact that Governor Tarullo made sure that he said in his testimony that he believed that, correct me if I'm wrong, he did believe that the agencies had the ability to push off the rulemaking without having to go back and ask for a legislative sort of approval for that. Did he say, I think he said that in his testimony.
I stand by whatever Governor Tarullo said in his testimony, word for word.
Concept of having, and we've seen this in other interim final rules, so you could sort of have some sort of principle-based interim final rules while they work on how the actual Volcker rule should be implemented itself.
But isn't that then effectively the statute, just leaving it as it is and working on the rule? It seems to me, though, that if you do something like that and you leave everyone hanging a little bit because you're saying, you know, don't worry about it, take your time, we're figuring this out, you're figuring this out, we'll figure it out together. So then at what point do you decide, well, now we're going to bring an enforcement action and we're going to tell everyone how this really works? I mean, what comfort can you give folks that that's not going to happen?
Probably not going to be in the comfort providing business today. all I can tell you is that we understand the challenges of trying to come into compliance with a regime that is not yet fully finalized and is very complicated. Even if it were to be finalized in exactly the form in which it's proposed, it's clearly a very significant task to get your business running consistent with all the different principles and metric production requirements in our proposal. So we understand that it's going to take some time, it's going to take some work to get up and running, and we understand you'd like to have a final rule in your hands right now so you can begin planning, but you know, we're just not in that world. We're in this universe, and we're going to work as hard as we can to get the rule done as fast as we can to give you as much planning time as, give the industry as much planning time as they can get, but we've got some work to do.
In regard to your point about the enforcement action, the rule does allow, or the proposed rule allows for a conformance period of 2 years where it says, it speaks in the preamble about it not being something enforcement-based, that it understands it's something that'll take time to implement. I think, again, going back to Governor Tarullo's speech, there was discussion there about the importance of the metrics and the importance of having that reporting in order to think through some of the alternatives that may come up as part of the comment period and thinking through the final rule. So as we advise our clients at PwC, we're telling them, look, you know, let's focus on what we think is most likely to be implemented. So the fact is you're likely going to be called to have a reporting regime, so a metric regime. So you should be working right now to figure out what metrics you can produce. What's the story those metrics say to get a really good sense of how vulnerable you are to the final rule whenever it's produced?
Can I just add in something? One thing that's important to distinguish between here when you're talking about whether there will be rules or won't be rules on the effective date. In other words, whether the statute goes into effect on the effective date without rules or without sufficient rules. You have to distinguish between three different prohibitions. One is a prohibition on prop trading, which, given the way the conformance rules work, you could continue entering into transactions during that conformance period until either the agency sort of extended or say, here's the deadline and now you have to stop this stuff. The other is sponsoring or investing in hedge funds or private equity funds. Again, relatively easy to do because you can look at the statute and say, I can still set them up under something called the asset management exemption and continue setting up new ones, and you would continue to retain your interest in the pre-existing funds during the conformance period, and so you've got two or more years to actually bring those into conformance. The one prohibition that it's not at all clear, unless the agencies were to do something, has the same kind of delay sort of built in, or the ability to delay, and that is something called that's referred to as Super 23A, which basically prohibits a banking entity from entering into what are called covered transactions, so lending to someone or buying assets from a fund. And because of the way the fund, a hedge fund or private equity fund, are defined in the statute, it's not clear that those things don't include some wholly owned subs and other affiliates. And so on day one, it could be that banking groups are unable to enter into these funding, intercompany funding agreements and risk management agreements, or continue entering into them. Those could be prohibited on day one, and there's no conformance period to continue entering into those. So that would probably be the most disruptive thing, is the uncertainty about what a covered fund is and the immediate effectiveness of so-called Super 23A.
Thanks for that clarification. And I guess along those lines, Mark, there's been a lot of criticism about Super 23A, and I wondered if you had any thoughts about or could shed any light on why you all came to the place you did in the proposal.
A second theme of any further remarks I'll be making today is that Congress specified a lot of things in the Volcker Rule and gave us limited flexibility, I think, to fix what we might have fixed if we could design the framework ourselves. On the Super 23A front, Congress did decide to say that banking entities should no longer be allowed to provide certain kinds of support to advised funds. They applied the restrictions of 23A and 23B to the relationships between not just the bank and the advised fund, but the entire banking entity, the bank holding company and the advised fund, and did not carry over the 23A exceptions that are in 23A when it did so. The Volcker Rule does have some ability of the agencies to provide additional exemptions if they meet a certain set of strict standards. But it's a difficult set of special exemption authorities to use. But Congress's fundamental decision here did not carry over the 23A exceptions into Super 23A in the Volcker Rule, and our proposal was to carry that forward. But we're, you know, eager to take comments and receive comments on what ways, you know, the policy decision about whether it's the right thing to do to carry it over, and, you know, what legal authorities we have or what mechanism under the text of the Volcker Rule would enable us to do that.
You mentioned that if you had designed the framework yourself, it would have looked different than it does. If you could make one change in the statute, what would that be?
I'm not going to answer any question like that today.
It's worth a try. All right, Randy, you said you were interested in being provocative, so I think it's fair to ask you a tough question as well. Simon Johnson has made the case that, and I'm quoting him here, we should expect executives from big banks to oppose removal of subsidies. To the extent that such subsidies may be expected to benefit shareholders, it can be argued that these executives have a fiduciary responsibility to do all they can to ensure that the effectiveness of the Volcker Rule be undermined. Is that what's really going on with all these critiques of the Volcker Rule? Should we just ignore them as simply desperate pleas of an industry fearful of losing the subsidies that have served it so well?
Well, first of all, I think the subsidy argument is often misused, and I think Professor Johnson is misusing it here, because no one is actually talking about the insured banks themselves, who are the ones that enjoy deposit insurance, engaging in proprietary trading and market making. What we're actually talking about is the broker-dealer affiliates or other affiliates engaging. It's the way broker-dealers have done for the last at least century in this country, including during the Glass-Steagall era. There are firewalls. There is regular 23 and 23B that insulate the insured banks from the risks of the activities of the affiliates. So there is no subsidy, there is no cross subsidy for those proprietary trading market making activities that are occurring outside the bank. So, you know, Professor Johnson, I just don't think understands how the banking laws work, in particular the firewalls created by 23A and 23B.
Sally, can you talk a little bit about how U.S. investors might be restrained in the amount of options that are available to them because of the restrictions in the rule in connection with their dealing with foreign entities?
Well, I think you're referring, Hester, to the fact that in the fund section that we are not able, under the statute, to sell to U.S. investors. What happened in the solely outside the U.S., they said you can operate a non-U.S. fund, but they added an extra requirement, Congress did, to say, because they wanted to make sure for competitive parity issues, that we would not be able to sell to U.S. investors. And so they've built in a restriction that we cannot sell our non-U.S. funds to U.S. investors. So it does remove some sort of option that they might have in terms of these exemptions. The other thing I think is important to note is that the Volcker Rule does not impact mutual funds that are publicly traded, et cetera, so there's no prohibition on selling mutual funds. But it doesn't have the same type of carve-out for what one would consider to be the analogs in foreign government, foreign countries, so UCITS and Canadian type of mutual funds. They are not exempt from that. So there is another sort of, and those type of funds do take advantage of the I won't get into the details, are potentially impacted by this rule. So that's another situation. We also, I think, just if I can, since I have the floor here, the way the fund provision is also structured, it says that you can't use, this is what the agencies have put in there, is you can't use any persons to affect, you know, the sales of the non-U.S. fund. Now, we already know we can't sell the fund to U.S. investors, but what about having people here, jobs here, where we sell non-U.S. funds to non-U.S. persons? And we do that. For example, you might have somebody, an example might be down in Houston, doing an oil and gas type of fund, selling it to Latin American investors. So if we can't do that, that's a job loss here with respect to our non-U.S. funds. And there was something else I wanted to say, and I've forgotten it, in terms of the fund issues. I'll come back to it
well,
if I think.
Along those lines, is it going to scare foreign entities away from using any of our infrastructure here, too? Clearinghouses.
Well, that's certainly been an issue that the OFSFI the Ontario Financial Supervisor has raised, because for at least for the Canadians, as they said, I think the word they used was ubiquitous, is that they use DTCC, they use the exchanges and everything else like that, and there's a real concern as to this solely outside interpretation, whether it would impact that. We think at a minimum the requirement that you can't use a U.S. execution venue does impact all of the exchanges and the CEFs and sort of trading platforms, but there are others that think it might impact clearance and settlement, and that would impact DTCC and on other entities similar to that. So, yes.
Mark, do you want to weigh in on that? Do you think that it goes beyond just execution facilities?
I think the rule talked about execution facilities, but again, when Congress set the basic framework out in the Volcker Rule for how to deal with the cross-border issues, it applied the Volcker Rule to U.S. firms in their global operations. It created an exemption for foreign banks in their activities that were solely outside the United States. Solely means solely. It's a pretty strict word. They could have chosen other words. They could have said primarily or predominantly. It said solely. That has put some serious restrictions on our ability, our interpretive ability, to show a lot of flexibility in this area. So when a transaction is being done with a U.S. counterparty through a U.S. exchange with U.S.-based personnel, it's difficult to say that solely. So, you know, the Congress kind of set the basic parameters for how to deal with these cross-border issues. We started from the congressional language and the congressional intent. We're seeking comment on all of these issues. So if Sally or others of her colleagues or foreign governments or foreign banks or U.S. banks have some comments on ways that we can implement the statute that work better, that respect the text of the statute and our limited exemptive authority, we're happy to take those comments. But we felt like what we were doing was consistent with the text and spirit of the text.
Actually, we believe that solely modifies the principal activities. And in Mark's first comments, he talked about trading being a principal activity and defined. And we think the statute really goes to where the risk is, that it's at least it's offshore and it has to be the principal activity. So the prohibition goes provided that the trading occurs solely outside of the United States. That's an example. And we think solely modifies trading and nothing more. Mark and his colleagues at the other agencies have felt that that's why they needed to add on those two restrictions I was talking to you about, that you can't sell to a U.S. person and you can't use a U.S. execution platform. I did remember my other things on the fund, if that's okay. I think this might be actually more on point to your question, but the way the prohibition on marketing to U.S. residents does make a concern as to whether a foreign bank can invest in a third-party fund if it has U.S. investors, so we're, you know, not anywhere connected to us. Can you invest in a third-party fund if it has U.S. investors? Because again, you know, you're not supposed to be invested in funds that are marketed to U.S. investors. And then the other thing is that if we do have a non-U.S. fund and we obey the rules and don't sell it to a U.S. person and we sell it to, let's say, a U.K. resident, and then they go and sell after that in the secondary market, we can't be expected to police that as well. So those are the two other areas of the funds that I think could have a chilling effect as well on U.S. investors being able to invest in these funds.
Nice to add something, because we actually, there was a four trade group letter that I had worked on, and we had sort of picked up this one point. This is actually really important, because unless that offshore exemption is read the way Sally and her organization is suggesting, which it is completely open to it, because they use the passive voice, and so you can interpret it, the amount of foreign investment in the United States will be cut down by $40 or $50 billion, because foreign banks are some of the biggest limited partner passive investors in hedge funds and private equity funds in the United States, and that's one of the biggest channels for foreign investment in the United States. So if foreign banks, you know, if they structure investment and they invest it in a fund, and all of a sudden some third party, not them, but a third party sells an interest or offers interest to a U.S. resident, now they've actually got to yank their money out. That actually means that foreign banks will have to be yanking out tens of billions of dollars of money that's invested in the United States.
Well, they're not going to do it, Randy, because they're not going to get assurance from the fund provider that they will never sell to a U.S. investor, so they just won't put their money in the first place, probably, right?
So you've got the problem with the existing funds now that they'll have to conform, and then you've got deterrence on new investment. This is one that I actually think will be fixed, in part because in his comment letter, Senator Merkley actually suggested that it should be interpreted in the way that the IAB is suggesting, which would allow foreign banks to actually continue investing in U.S. banks as long as the foreign banks themselves don't offer and sell interest to a U.S. resident.
Corey, I was surprised by something you said, which is that you thought the compliance requirements are pretty reasonable. Can you talk us through a little bit more what you're telling clients to do in terms of preparing?
Sure. And when I was talking about the compliance requirements being reasonable, I was taking off the table that solely outside the U.S. So the fact that if you have a head office or an operation outside the U.S. and you're a foreign organization, and you just continue to deal with U.S. customers, you would be sort of sucked into this rule, and you would have to likely report, but definitely have a compliance program in. So the compliance program, as it's been designed, or as it's suggested in the proposal, you know, talks about having a series of policies and procedures, having some sort of oversight. It doesn't dictate, for example, where the sort of monitoring and analysis needs to be done, so it's flexible, so it can be implemented from a standpoint of whether your middle office, risk management, a number of different areas could actually be responsible for the actual day-to-day monitoring. It has a fairly robust independent testing requirement, which is more specific than what you see in other guidance. So it wants an independent third party, independent meaning independent from the business line and or the middle office. So, but it does actually suggest in the text that, you know, you could think of independent third party outside of the organization itself. So there's nothing in there that I think was a huge shocker. That said, I think in order to be responsible and actually do any kind of compliance, you're really going to have to do a fairly significant technology build, particularly if the rule continues to sort of get at transaction by transaction type monitoring. At a portfolio level, you're still going to have to do a technology build. But if you're talking about understanding how each technology, where the bid offer spread, did you provide liquidity to the market on that trade, or did you take liquidity from the market on that trade? Is this a hedge? Again, just to take a second here, for traders, hedges are sometimes something you go out specifically and buy to hedge a position or exposure, but sometimes you have natural hedges, hedges that come out as just as part of your customer facilitation. So how do I designate, because part of the exemption says, well, you have to substantiate that your hedges are correlated, it doesn't include any kind of, you know, introduce a new risk, et cetera. But the fact is, my client activity sometimes is a hedge, so how do I have to deal with that? And are you telling me that at the and that's another part of it, it says at the initiation of the hedge, you need to indicate it as that. Well, if customer A transaction is actually helping me to hedge customer B transaction, how do I deal with the customer transaction? Is it the hedge? Is it not? So I think there's a number of aspects that monitoring as it comes in design seems reasonable, but we'll see when we get the details of the rule and what the actual expectations would be.
So, Randy, I guess we can look forward to some job creation here. We're going to get independent third-party testers, and we're going to get people to fix Sally's eyes after she reads legislative text that small, or sort of little text that small. Mark, last July, the GAO issued a report on proprietary trading and covered fund activities, and they looked at the six largest bank holding companies and found that compared to these firms' overall revenues, their standalone proprietary trading generally produced small revenues in most quarters and some larger losses during the financial crisis. But they also found that losses from these firms' other activities, which include lending activities and other activities that could potentially be defined as proprietary trading, affected their overall net incomes more during this period than the standalone proprietary trading and fund investments. So, I mean, they face the same difficulty that I think you do, which is it's pretty hard to define proprietary trading, but it does seem that they were suggesting that proprietary trading losses were really not what was behind the crisis. Do you have any counter evidence on that or any thoughts on that?
I won't directly answer your question, but I'll kind of meander around it a little bit. Congress made a decision that the social benefits of the Volcker Rule exceeded the cost of the Volcker Rule, and so they adopted it, and our job is to implement. I do think it's very difficult, I think, to quantify what part of the crisis might have been caused by bad prop trades that banking firms did and what might have been caused by 50,000 other things, in part because, as you say, the banking agencies have not historically asked banks to classify their different securities or derivatives positions as market making versus prop, so we haven't kind of kept that data. The banks a lot of times haven't kept that data. They've had some separate prop trading desks where they're clearly prop and they've had some gains and they've had some losses at various different times, but in general, through their vast trading operations, they haven't distinguished clearly between the prop and the market making. I think it's fair to say that prop trading wasn't a core cause of the financial crisis, but I think it's also important to note, and this seems to get lost by both sides of the debate on the Volcker Rule, that there is a global consensus around the need to improve the regulation, to strengthen the regulation of trading risks in banking firms. So in addition to the Volcker Rule in the United States, there's also been a very active movement globally. The Basel Committee has adopted the Basel 2.5 and the Basel III capital reforms, which will materially raise capital requirements on trading operations of banks. Basel has adopted a liquidity rule regime, which is brand new, and will clearly impose some of its highest regulatory taxes on the kinds of unstable funding practices that a lot of the trading firms had used to finance their trading positions. The whole movement in derivatives towards central clearing and margin requirements for non-cleared derivatives, again, is going to make it a lot more expensive to do those kinds of derivatives trading activities, all with the goal of, I think, reducing the trading risk that banks have. So it's important to consider the Volcker Rule in that broader context, I think.
Comment on that. It's very interesting when you look at Mr. Volcker's comment letter. He keeps referring to commercial banks and the Volcker Rule applying to commercial banks, and Mark just referred to the Basel rules applying to banks. And that's actually really important because there's a distinction between banks and non-banks, at least in this country. And the Basel rules really do apply to banks and trading within banks. They don't apply and have never applied to bank holding companies or affiliates of banks. Now, the U.S. has applied capital rules to holding companies and affiliates and other things, but there really is a difference. And that's actually important because if you actually look at the administration's original version of the Volcker Rule, it only applied the prohibitions on prop trading to insured banks. It did not apply to the securities affiliates of banks. That came later when it was expanded to cover the other institutions. If you look at the UK, they have something that often is incorrectly described as sort of a version of the Volcker Rule, so-called ring fencing of retail banking. If you read those carefully, though, they talk about they had a choice between partial separation and what they call total separation between retail banking and market making. And they expressly opted for partial separation, meaning they put, in many ways, it's just going to the U.S. model where commercial banking is inside a bank, and then you have separate affiliates with firewalls like 23 and 23B where they do their market making and proprietary trading. All of that will continue to be permitted within a banking group. And so it's very important to separate these various international regulatory proposals and so forth, which apply to banks, and where there are distinctions between banks and non-banks. And here in the U.S., where with the Volcker Rule, although the distinction was made early on, it was erased during the legislative process so that it applies to the entire group. And so there's you have to be careful about the mismatch between that.
Although everything else Randy Gwynn has said today is absolutely correct, I think there are a couple things in that response that weren't factually. I'm pretty sure the administration's proposal originally was not limited just to insured banks. I think out of the gate, I think it was to all companies that owned an insured bank as well as the insured bank subsidiary, but we can clearly check the fact on that and make sure see who's right. And then on the scope of application of the Basel capital rules, Randy's right that the original Basel I capital rules only applied to banks, but I'm pretty sure in the Basel II changes that were made in 2004, it was also extended to the banking group, the holding companies of banks. So I think the landscape has changed a little bit on that.
But Mark, do you agree that the efforts that are being looked at in other countries, like the ring fencing, there's no talk about putting that on extraterritorially, right?
Yeah, I don't want to get into the very complicated details of the UK-specific proposals around ring fencing, but there are some interesting cross-border aspects to that, too.
Just to switch gears a little bit, as you know, the SEC lost a case recently for not doing adequate economic analysis, and so clearly all the regulators are rethinking what they need to do in terms of figuring out the costs and benefits of what they're doing. How has that decision played into the work that you all are doing?
I'll give some of my classic comments, and then I'll have another kind of classic. So I'm not in the legal function at the Fed anymore, so I can't give you any kind of legal opinion about whether we are required by law or this new case to actually do the kinds of cost-benefit analysis that the SEC has been required to do. But that said, clearly, we asked a lot of questions in the document. Many of the 1,400 questions were about the costs and benefits of different aspects of the proposal. So we're clearly very interested in getting input from a wide variety of public citizens in the industry around where the costs are high, where the benefits are low, to help tailor our final rule. And I think that's pretty consistent with how the Fed or any other agency does its regulations, even though we may or may not be subject to a specific quantitative cost-benefit analysis. We always do the best we can to attempt to quantify and certainly to do a qualitative assessment of the cost and benefits of various different interpretive angles that we could take on the text or uses of exemptive authority under various different regulatory regimes. So we've certainly done, as we've crafted the rule, tried in our give our best efforts to adopt interpretive approaches that we thought best promoted financial stability, best promoted the safety and soundness of banks at the least cost to the liquidity of the financial markets. Happy to hear where we got that wrong, and we're certainly going to be kind of rethinking through all that analysis as we take a look at the 17,000 comments and what quantitative or qualitative analysis they've done of the costs and benefits.
I think Chairman Volker pointed out one area where you'd gotten it wrong in the sense that, and Randy referred to this in his remarks, he said that liquidity is overrated, and that at some point actually liquidity is harmful to investors, because it I believe his reasoning was that it encourages people to invest in things that maybe they shouldn't. Randy, I don't know if you want to comment a little bit more on how the rule will work for less liquid products.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I think the proprietary trading rule has metrics that are really derived from the equity markets. And the real problem is going to be with the corporate debt markets, because unlike common stock, where when you issue it and you issue more, it's all fungible, and so you have this big pool that's being traded. When corporates issue debt securities, each issue of debt securities tends to be its sort of own issue, and they don't trade fungibly because they have different terms, they have different interest rates, they have different durations, and so forth. And so the liquidity of those instruments is much less than it is with equity securities. And so and in order to actually provide liquidity so that people are able to buy and sell corporate debt securities in a liquid way, in a transparent way, and to have as transparent of prices as possible, institutions actually need to be able to carry inventories. And they might even have to carry inventories for a long time. And at least under the rule as it's proposed, that would be an indicator or a presumption that the position is a prop trading position, even if it's being held to accommodate and promote the interests of customers. And so that's one of the things that a lot of the comment letters have focused on is the importance of allowing genuine market making. One of the wrong turns is that there's been a lot written to suggest that somehow, and by a lot of people that I think ought to know better. I don't think the agencies have ever said this, but suggests that market making really is kind of a brokerage business. It's riskless principle. You have almost no risk in market making. That's just fundamentally a mischaracterization of the world in which we have lived in for the last 100 years. Market making, depending on the asset class, involves risk taking. It involves holding it, and you're compensated not by commissions, but by the spread between the bids and the asks, or the buys and the sells. And so that's going to be a real problem with the way it works.
All right, well, I'd like to open it up to questions from the floor, just to ask you to please keep them to questions. If you start making a statement, you're going to get conscripted for the public reading of the proposal, which will take place afterwards. Anyone have questions?
Bertie, a question, I think primarily for Randy and Sally. And this harks back to the liquidity provisions in Basel III. Isn't there fundamentally a conflict between what the Volcker rule is trying to do with regard to liquidity and the liquidity requirements under Basel III? Aren't they going to clash in some way? And then
To follow on to that, you talked about how this can impact the corporate market. What about the municipal market, particularly the role the community banks play in the municipal market in providing a market for oftentimes what are very small issues of municipal securities by relatively small local governments?
Let me try. I wish my partner Bob Colby were here, who is more of an expert on the prop trading side of the rules than I am. But let me just say, I really think that anything, including the Volcker rule, that undermines liquidity of banking assets is inconsistent with the liquidity requirements in Basel III. Those operate in two different ways. One is your assets become increasingly liquid rather than being illiquid, or you have longer-term liabilities so that there aren't going to be runs on the institution. That is addressing head-on the fundamental characteristics of banks and financial institutions that make them susceptible to runs during financial crises. If the Volcker Rule has the effect that I think it will have and could have, it will actually, at the it will actually replace, let's just assume that prop trading is in U.S. and foreign government securities. Those are quite liquid assets. Those would be on the bank's balance sheet or the bank affiliate's balance sheet if they're actually allowed to engage in activities. If they're prohibited from engaging in those activities, those assets will disappear, replaced by loans. And 30-year loans are about as illiquid and opaque as assets get. They are not safe activities. This was actually the argument in favor of Gramm-Leach-Bliley years ago, is that, in fact, underwriting and dealing in securities is actually less risky than lending, and I think that still remains the case today. On the point about municipal securities, there's no question that that's true, too. I picked out corporate bonds, but the same thing with municipal securities. If the bank holding companies are not allowed to market make in municipal securities for fear of it being categorized or presumed to be illegal proprietary trading, then the liquidity for municipal bonds will dry up. What does that mean? That means borrowing costs skyrocket because investors will demand much higher interest rates if their securities are going to be illiquid. A huge illiquidity premium will be demanded.
For Randy, you know, you just said that you think the banks are going to be increasing 30-year loans, but it would seem to me, based on the Volcker Rule, what they're really going to be going into is U.S. government securities. And we've seen twice where government privileging of its own securities has led to a complete disaster in holding company standards. One is in Europe, where the Basel requirements privileged sovereign debt being owned by the European banks, complete disaster. And here you had the same thing with the banks that were drawn into holding these huge amounts of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae securities, which were supposed to be, of course, risk-free. So it seems to me this is just another step in the direction of the great financial downfall of the United States. However, that's not my question. My question is, I like everything that you had to say, but I don't understand why, in terms of the market, we wouldn't expect to see this function of trading corporate debt, municipals, all the rest of it. Just have, you know, we'll have new entities that will enter into the market that are not banks, that have nothing to do with FDIC. And if there's a dollar to be made in that activity, you know, there'll be entrants. And in that sense, it will create jobs. Some of the unemployed Wall Streeters or people who work for Goldman now will be stepping in. Why isn't that the case?
Okay. I think it's indisputable that there will be new entrants in response to, you know, opportunities to make profits. But the question is, how long will it take for those entrants to enter and approximate anything near what we have today in market making? For instance, the best way to illustrate this is a way in which my partner Bob Colby has on a number of meetings I'm into, which he says, can you name any of the broker-dealers that are not currently affiliated with an insured bank? And almost no one can name them. And in fact, there are like two or three, Jefferies. There are a couple of hedge funds. The hedge funds don't want to be registered broker-dealers. Now, with enough profit, maybe they will decide that it's worthwhile. But there will be a big time lag between now and then when there's actually any serious amount of liquidity being provided by these third parties. The other thing is, if they actually become truly successful in market making, then they might themselves be designated as systemically important by the Federal Reserve and the FSOC. And under the Volcker Rule, it's sort of contemplated that in addition to banking entities, systemically important non-financial institutions will be subject to, or can be subject to, similar limitations as in the Volcker Rule. So it'd be very possible that hedge fund, if it gets big enough, gets designated systemically important, and then you say, oh, the additional metrics is you can't engage in prop trading except to certain percentages or with these super capital requirements and so forth, which could have a similar effect. So that is, you know, who knows what will happen there, and you're right that we can expect new entrants to sort of provide that, but there aren't any entrants sitting there right now ready to take up that volume.
I just want to emphasize, sort of repeat what Randy said. I think I've heard two sides of it. There's people who are not sure that there are going to be new entrants who can afford to do the capital-intensive, sort of customer-driven, market-making activities that banking entities have done. So that's one side of the equation. Are there, in fact, going to be entities that can step in? And if, in fact, there are entities, as we're supposing there might be, that will go to the shadow banking system, don't have the sort of supervision that the banking entities now have, and are you leading yourself down a path of having risky activities outside of a, if you even agree, and I'm not saying I agree that they're risky, but if you posit that they're risky activities and shouldn't be in the banking system, now they're not supervised.
Bert's question, though, a little bit on the liquidity rules. I think we are trying to the maximum extent possible that we can, consistent with our authorities under the Volcker Rule, to make the Volcker Rule sync up with all the new Basel-related capital and liquidity reforms. One way that we've tried to do that in the Volcker Rule is to put in a specific exception for liquidity management portfolios. So, you know, the LCR, the innovation of the LCR that Basel has come up with is that it forces banks to self-insure against their liquidity risks by holding on balance sheet meaningfully large portfolios of high-quality governments and corporate securities. And we've clarified in the Volcker Rule that to the extent a bank or a bank holding company is holding a portfolio of those securities to meet its liquidity needs, whether they're regulatory liquidity requirements or the bank's own internal assessment of its liquidity needs, those kinds of holdings are not the kinds of holdings that we think the Volcker Rule is targeted at, and we've interpreted them kind of out of the trading account.
Is anyone else?
Mark will be glad that I'm going to start by scolding Randy and not him. For the use of the word enemies, from our international point of view, we're all in the same globalized boat, and making everybody's markets work better is in everybody's interest. And therefore, the question is, what can be done to attenuate the really extraordinary extraterritoriality of the Volcker Rule? And it's also, I think it's important to keep in mind that in terms of the impact on other countries, this is coming at the same time we have truly extraordinary extraterritorial impact on other countries' systems, compliance, a zillion other things through FATCA. So it's the timing is not at all good there. But what can be done to attenuate the foreign bank problem, the extraterritorial impacts on foreign banks, and also the extraterritorial impacts on U.S. banks' activities abroad?
First of all, I always hate to be scolded by David, so I will defend myself. There are a handful of enemies, believe it or not, and there are these sanctions on various countries that are identified as enemies of the United States, and that's what I was really thinking of. To the extent we are weaker, our markets are weaker, you know, that's good for them. So, but most of the world is actually our friends and competitors, but there are sort of competitive advantages and disadvantages from the Volcker Rule the way it's set up now, and I do think that that is not in the U.S. interest to sort of create that. As far as what can be done, unfortunately, I have to be with Mark on this one. There's limits to what can be done to remedy the extraterritorial impact of the Volcker Rule because of the statutory language solely outside the U.S. I do agree with Sally that I don't think the agencies had to go further and sort of broaden what is sort of captured as opposed to by the plain language of the statute. But I do think that there are serious limits. I don't think that there's really authority, at least now, to ease a lot of the extraterritorial impacts, other than sort of rules like, you know, the Morrison decision or other sort of general principles of limits of our extraterritorial jurisdiction.
David, obviously, I think that we'd want to see them exercise their rulemaking authority to do some sort of parity with respect to foreign government securities. That's one thing that can be done. On the Randy's right in terms of the competitive issues for U.S. banks operating offshore, they don't they don't have a similar solely outside the U.S. exception like we do. There have been some suggestions by smarter people than me, and so don't ask me to give any more detail on it, but there may be ways for the bank regulators to come up with something that would help the U.S. banks in their offshore activities. For example, limit their prop trading, if it's allowed in that country, to some percentage of economic capital or something like that, to at least give something there. But ultimately, that was a decision by Congress as to how the Volcker Rule was going to apply for U.S. firms. And I sort of agree with Randy. I mean, the agency's hands are tied in that respect. So, I mean, we have to look to the Congress to fix it, and I'm not going to handicap that.
Anyone else?
Well, it is interesting, you know, in the non-Volcker activity restrictions the bank holding companies are subject to, there's a provision of the Bank Holding Company Act that specifically empowers the Fed to say to U.S. firms, but if this particular activity restriction doesn't really make sense abroad and puts you at a competitive disadvantage, the Fed can provide some exemptive relief explicitly to deal with that situation, and we've done it a number of times in our Regulation K. But the Volcker Rule was just done differently by Congress, and we don't have that similar authority to allow U.S. banks to do certain things abroad, even if it was important for them to achieve competitive equity with foreign banks.
Well, that's a common refrain when talking about Dodd-Frank, that Congress didn't give the regulators the easiest statute to work with. So I think on that note, we'll end. And thanks to all the panelists for coming today and talking to us.
My name is Wayne Abernathy. I'm Executive Vice President at the American Bankers Association, but I'm also privileged to be the chairman of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group. And on behalf of the Federalist Society and the ABA, I want to thank all of you for coming here, for showing how important this issue is. And I want to leave you with one final thought, which is that in Washington, no debate ever ends. So we'll be talking with these fine panelists again and again in the days to come. And please join with me in thanking our panelists once again.